Hey friends, welcome to All Have Another Podcast with Lindsay Hine. I'm your host, Lindsay. Thank you for being here today. If you're new to the show, welcome. And if you're returning, welcome back. I so appreciate you being here. Today you're listening to episode 54, and I'm talking with Mary Catherine Hamm. Mary Catherine is a political journalist. She's a CNN political commentator. She's the author of the book End of Discussion, and she's the mom of two adorable little girls. In this episode, we talk about her career. We also talk about the marathons that she's ran, how she hiked Mount Kilimanjaro on her honeymoon. Then we go a little deep as well. In 2015, Mary Catherine's husband, Jake, lost his life in a tragic bike accident when she was 7 months pregnant. So we go into how she's coped with that, how she's dealt with that, and how she's chosen to find the possibility of a happy life in the midst of a tragic situation. The woman has strength, courage, and grit, and you guys are really going to enjoy this conversation with her. Before we get started talking with Mary Catherine, I want to thank Now Foods for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Now Foods has been a leader in the natural health foods industry since 1968, and I order my supplements and vitamins, my protein powder for them. You can also get food from them. Lots of great stuff over there. Go check out their website, now-2-u.com, and you guys can enter promo code ANOTHER, all caps, to get 25% off your order. All right, guys, if you're loving the show, I would really appreciate it if you would leave me a rating and review on iTunes. It's the best way for potential new listeners to find the show. And I just dropped my third bonus episode over on my Patreon page at patreon.com/Lindsay Hine. Hi, buddy. All right, guys, I'm sitting here with Russ, and we have friends coming over here to play. I invited my girlfriend, Allie, to come over, and then I invited another girl from the neighborhood, and then I started texting everybody, and I ended up inviting like 10 girls over and their kids. So I don't know how many people are going to show up, but I feel like I'm going to have like 20 people in my house here on a Thursday afternoon, and I think we're going to have some wine. I think that's going to have to be involved in the process. It's funny because I always say I want to like every other week have girls over, you know, in the afternoon from like 4 to 6 or something like that to get through the end of the day when the end of the day is feeling long. So I'm kind of scared to commit to it though, because you know how you have weeks where you're feeling really good and weeks where you're feeling really crappy. And I was like, what if I'm committed to having these people over to my house like every other week or something, and I'm having a really crappy week and I just don't want to see anybody. And then I reminded myself that usually when that's happening, when I feel crappy or when I'm feeling sorry for myself or when I'm, you know, whatever, my hormones are crazy and I'm just in a funk, usually I want to curl up in a ball and hide from everybody, but I know what the best thing to do is to actually be around other people. It just takes some motivation to get there. So anyway, my whole point is I think I'm going to commit to this. I think it's going to be fun, especially now that the weather's getting nice. All right, everybody, that's all I got for you. Enjoy my conversation with Mary Catherine.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very sorry that this took so long for me to figure out, but I'm glad to talk to you.
Yeah. I mean, I looked back through the emails. I think it was like August. Was it August? Yes. Or September?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm super excited though. My sister Erica connected us.
Yes.
And when did you guys meet? How long have you, I feel like you've known her for a really long time.
Yeah, we've known each other since way back in the day in DC, I want to say, long before either of us was married or had kids. So
we're talking to Mary Catherine Hamm, and can you tell everybody a little bit where you grew up and just a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, and was actually born in Alabama, grew up in North Carolina, went to college in Georgia, so it's very southern despite the relative lack of accent, which has sadly disappeared since I've lived in DC for too long. But yeah, grew up in Durham. My mom was a public school teacher. My dad was a newspaper man. So here I am doing politics and news junkie stuff.
When did you get interested in that, in this kind of political career?
So I think my family wasn't particularly political, but they were news junkies. Like I said, my dad was a newspaper man. He was the editor of the local paper. So I think we were always a family that paid attention to politics, but we weren't super ideological. I never felt like my parents were pushing any candidates on me or any particular ideology on me. we did live in a very liberal town, and I think a bit of my, it's, you know, these are my beliefs, but there's a bit of contrarianism at work as well, where as a kid I was like, everyone believes one thing. Maybe I believe something different. So I think some of that was at play. And my parents are both, grew up as military brats. So that put us a little bit to the right, I think, of a lot of the families in the neighborhood. So yeah, we were very comfortable being sort of the odd man out in this very liberal town. And I think I may have been conservative or identified as conservative or libertarian before my parents even did.
And that's a really interesting point you bring up, that you said your parents didn't kind of push any sort of candidate or anything on you. Gosh, we can get into this later, but I'm just thinking about when you raise your daughters, how do you, when they get a little bit older, how will you think about talking about politics with them and all that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So my late husband, which we can address that later, was a Democrat. And he, you know, he even worked in the Obama administration in technology for a while I was on the right, often on TV, criticizing his boss. So we sort of bridged that gap, and you know, there were challenges there as well. But I think the two of us always agreed after we met, and he, of course, was a Democrat from Tennessee, who went to the Naval Academy for 2 years. So it's like, there's a limit on how liberal you can be having grown up with those two factors. So I think he's sort of a centrist pragmatist kind of guy, which didn't put us that far apart. And I think we both agreed that, hey, it's perfectly possible to be on two sides of the political spectrum or slightly apart on the political spectrum and also have similar values about how to raise children and have a family. And so that was what was important to us. And to neither one of us was the politics central to life, ironically, despite the fact that our jobs were very wrapped up in it. I think part of my philosophy on life is that, and one of the reasons I'm conservative, actually, is that I think people should have to think about politics less instead of more. And I'm sort of like, this is my job, so it doesn't have to be your job. And so I think embracing those other parts of life was, you know, a huge part of our marriage and a huge part of what how I like to live life and what I'd like to pass to my kids. It's like, hey, we can get along even when we even disagree a lot on things.
And can't everybody in the world use a little bit of that advice right now?
Yeah, it's in short supply right now. And I get it. Like emotions are high. I just think that, it is possible to communicate far better than we're doing at the moment. And it's not like I'm perfect at it, but I've always been a political minority in the communities that I've been in, whether it was college or my town. Despite being in the South, I was always, and in the newsroom, I guess, too, I was always to the right of most people. So I'm comfortable confronting a lot of people who disagree with me. And I think we should all maybe get a little bit more comfortable with that.
That's so good. I was going to dive into this with your husband a little bit later, but as far as, like, when you guys met, I mean, he was clearly a liberal and you're a conservative. Right. Like, did your families, you know, take note of that? Or were you hesitant to jump into the relationship because of that?
I mean, I think I had concerns. I think he did, too. Just in, like, is this going to cause problems on a day-to-day basis? And it's not as if it didn't cause any. I mean, I was like, I'm a person who's literally trained to debate people, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes having a discussion with your wife about something that seems fairly innocuous can turn into a debate if your wife is trained to be debating all the time. And that's something in my personal life that I try to tone down. But with him, I would sometimes let my flag fly and it's like, okay, we probably don't have to have a giant debate about this right now. But I think my family seemed very comfortable with it. They, of course, like after having met him, it was a no-brainer. Mm. I think his mom had like some reservations, but again, once she met me, it was like, oh, this makes sense. And again, they're all from Tennessee. It's not like they had never met anyone right of center before. So that part actually was not much of a problem. I think it, you know, we were both firstborns and made it pretty clear this was the direction we were going. And our families were like, yep, we trust you.
Oh, that's so good. I want to talk about Jake a little bit more, but first, when did you know though, that you like I want this to be my career. Like, I want my world to revolve, well, not my whole world, but you know what I mean? My everyday working life to revolve around politics.
Well, so I started out as a straight news reporter in North Carolina in a small town. I worked at a daily newspaper and it was really fun. I got to know, I just got to try a bunch of stuff. When this is sadly a job that, because of the economics of news gathering and how newspapers work now, this job doesn't really exist anymore, which is an entry level general assignment reporter at a local paper. Many of those papers are gone. Many of those jobs are gone. And it was really such a quick education, because you have to report on everything if you're at a tiny paper. Mm-hmm. So I did like middle school volleyball and high school football, as it was a big Friday Night Lights town, which was really fun. I did NASCAR and murders and murder trials and, you know, all sorts of things and a lot of features. So I just got to try my hand at a bunch of stuff. But even in a rural North Carolina newsroom, I was like, noticeably weird. And so politically, and it wasn't like I made a huge deal out of it, but I'd push back on certain notions and editorial meetings and stuff. And it just felt like if I was going to move up in that world, that I would just have to shut my mouth forevermore about such things, unless I was specifically doing op-eds for a paper, which is a much higher level job that you have to work your way up to, or unless I worked somewhere that had a conservative, you know, editorial stance, which are few and far between. And so I just thought, well, I could just go do political journalism or politics or opinion journalism and just be open about what I believe and be honest about it and try to be as fair as I can. And that has ended up feeling like a much better fit for me. And I happened to come along at just the time when sort of newspapers nosedived. And I had moved conveniently over into like the online space at exactly the right time to sort of own it and make, I hate the term, but make a brand for myself, which I didn't realize is what I was doing at the time. But it was just a whole new game, and you could explore a lot more, and there was a lot more freedom than there was in newspaper writing, and I really enjoyed it.
So when did things take off? Like, when did you know I'm a staple on these network TV channels now? You know.
I mean, I came to DC, I guess, in 2004. It wasn't until 2006 that I was on TV for the first time. And it was really just like someone, a friend of mine, couldn't do what they'd been asked to do. And they said, you should ask Mary Catherine. And I was like, okay. And so I tried it and I was really nervous, but it went fairly well. And it was the eve of the 2006 election. And the next day, which was like the day of, or the, yeah, the day before the election, I got a call back from CNN, said, do you want to be on Larry King Live tonight? And I said, you know, I've only been on TV once, right? and they were like, whatever. And, you know, I thought about it and I was like, well, maybe I should say no. I don't know if I'm prepared for this. And then I was like, well, this is Washington, D.C. And this town is built on young people doing things they're woefully unqualified for. And I'm just going to go for it. And so I did. And like, you know, it went fine, but there was the part where, you know, David Gergen, who's served in many administrations, was having to listen to a 26-year-old talk. Like, you know, but that's life. So that was my sort of first, I guess, break or what have you. But it wasn't until, you know, maybe 2 years later that I was, you know, routinely on the O'Reilly Factor, which was kind of my springboard to everything else. So fighting with Bill once a week was basically the greatest training in TV. So it's hard to be scared of other things once you've gone toe to toe with him. So I appreciate that very much.
Do you you've been doing this for so long now, but are there ever certain topics that you get a little bit nervous to talk on?
Yeah, I don't get super nervous anymore in general. It took about 3 years till I was not nervous, actually. It took a long time to sort of really get my feet under me. My mom always said I didn't look nervous, which I guess is the key. Uh-huh. But I think, you know, it took me a while. But still, I think if you get too comfortable, you're going to be sloppy. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually better for me if I get a topic thrown at me that I don't automatically know as well, because that requires some reporting and some research and talking to people who know things better than you. And I think part of doing this job is accepting the fact that you don't know everything, which is not is counterintuitive because you're going on TV as some, you know, as someone who has special insight, but having special insight requires sometimes calling people who know more than you. Like, so,
right.
So I attempt to keep my head about me and ask myself critical questions about, okay, what really do you know about this? And let's examine it you know, try to figure out exactly what your biases are and what information you're missing. So I think if you keep yourself doing that, it helps you to be a more honest broker.
So what are some of your favorite outlets to educate yourself on these things?
So I use like Twitter as my news feed, which may change in the near future because everybody's losing their minds on Twitter all day long every day. But it is a great news feed, and I just follow a bunch of reporters and a bunch of people who, you know, study the things and work in the areas that I'm commenting on. So it's hard to say that there's like a specific source. Mm-hmm. There are certainly specific journalists who I enjoy. I think like Jake Tapper is one of those folks. I like Martha McCallum at Fox News. I think she's a real straight shooter and smart. So I have a handful of people who I really enjoy reading. And then when it comes to foreign policy, I follow people like Eli Lake at Bloomberg, who really like has deep roots in this and knows far more than I ever will. that's a handful of them, but I just, you know, have this huge list of Twitter following that I do, and sometimes overwhelming, but good.
Now, speaking of Twitter, when I was kind of researching this, our conversation a little bit, I kind of went through your feed and checked out what your Twitter feed was all about, and I noticed a common theme that if people kind of, and I'm sure you deal with this a lot, like, might attack what you say.
Mm-hmm.
You're really good at being gracious and almost just saying, you know, like forgiving them for being rude to you.
Yeah. So I think that Twitter has, you know, many downsides. One of which is that like people will automatically sort of come at you like, this is combat, right? And it's, but if you nicely reply to them, not to everyone, some people are lost causes, but if you nicely reply, a lot of times people will be like, oh, you're like a real person. You're actually there. Mm-hmm. And they sort of rethink how they're addressing you. The other thing is, I think everyone, especially right now, is primed to think the worst of someone who's on the other side. And I'm in a weird position because I was pretty critical of Trump during the election. I remain critical, but I'm not as far from sort of the right-leaning, you know, folks surrounding him as some on the left are. So I'm in like kind of an odd position. The first thing that people assume is like, oh, you're being a Trump shill, and what did you have to say about this incident? And then I'll just, you know, bring up the fact that I actually was consistent about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, I did not expect that answer. So I think it's good to surprise people, and I like being surprised by people, and I think you can take the opportunity to do that on Twitter. In fact, just being gracious to people on Twitter can be surprising to them. So... I try not to take up too many hours arguing with people, but they do tend to respond in kind if you're a little bit sweeter about it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Erica, my sister, she sent me a link to the thread that you wrote about Karen Owens.
Yeah.
And I mean, I thought everything you said there, I read through it like 3 times. I mean, it's just really special coming from you, you know.
Yeah, this is a weird line to walk because it's like, oh, I don't want to make this about me because it's definitely not. But I also felt like I had a perspective on a recent widow that with children that I might be able to bring to the table, because everyone was so quick to go, well, how does this fit into like my political leanings? How does this moment, and not everyone, I say everyone, I'm being unfair, but so many. We're just saying, oh, I really honor her and her husband, but she's being used as a prop and she's being exploited. And the infantilization of her annoyed me because having been close to her shoes, not exactly in her shoes, you know, she's a grown woman. She made the decision to be there. She's a SEAL wife. She probably knows far more about the cost of freedom than many of us ever will. And she has grappled with the idea of the unthinkable happening probably her entire relationship and marriage. She's probably thought through some of this, and I felt like people were not allowing for her point of view. Like, they were so obsessed with Trump's motives and Trump's point of view on this that they didn't think through a woman whose husband just died, who has three kids to raise and keep his memory alive for them, was invited by the President of the United States. And it doesn't matter if you like him or don't like him. He's the President of the United States and her husband's commander-in-chief to sit in a joint session of Congress where her husband would be honored on national TV and everyone in the room would give him the standing ovation that he so richly deserves. And the whole nation would know his name. And the idea that she's supposed to say no to that because you don't like Trump seems to me a very small way to look at this. And if we get to a point where the commander-in-chief cannot honor the fallen and cannot, frankly, face up to the fact that there is a price to the fighting and to see that face-to-face, that's an important thing for our nation, and we shouldn't, even when it is a president and even when it is a political venue, that moment can transcend politics. And I was just asking people to, like, give it a thought about where she might have been coming from and give us as a country a chance to just go, thank you. Mm. Thank you, Mrs. Owens. Like, yeah. I think we cut ourselves off from that at our own peril. Like, that's not a good situation to be in.
Mm-mm. I really, really appreciated your perspective on that, for sure. And I had been like, I think I was working on my podcast and I was actually sitting on my couch and I had the TV on, but the volume was not on. And I kept showing the screen on this woman crying, standing, and I had no idea what was going on.
Right.
And then it was the very next day Erica sent me the link to your Twitter feed about it. And yeah, it's very powerful.
And it's a very tricky thing, and not that common a thing to mourn in an inherently public way. Like, it's a strange thing that not that many people do that I did. And so watching her do that, I felt like I had a more insight into that than many might, and thought that she just was, you know, full of grace and awesome. And I could imagine all the reasons that she was there. So
speaking on all this, we keep bringing up your husband, and, in 2015, you were pregnant with your second child, and you lost your husband in a tragic bike accident.
Yes. He was racing for a cancer charity in September of 2015, and it was an organized race and just a total freak thing. He was it's one of the great ironies of this, is that he was an incredibly skilled rider, a former semi-pro cyclist in college and a national champion in an event that included cycling in college. So it was like, I don't mean to laugh about it. It's just like so ridiculous on its face that it happened. And it's almost weirdly comforting that it was so impossible that Jake Brewer would die in a biking accident. I would worry about him when he would go out riding, like, in the country by himself, because obviously cars are not used to looking for cyclists out there. It never occurred to me to worry about him in an organized race. And yet this is how it went down. It was, you know, shocking and sudden, and, being 7 months pregnant was bizarre. It's like, I think back on that part of my life, which is now 18 months ago or so. And it's like watching a terrible Lifetime movie. And I thought that at the time. I was like, ugh, you're like this tragic, ridiculous 7 months pregnant widow. Like, how did this happen to you? But I mean, I don't know. I don't even know what to say about it. It's like, you wake up and you keep living every day. And that's what we had to do. And actually being pregnant keeps you from going down a lot of dark paths you might otherwise go down, because you have to take care of, I had to take care of not only my toddler, who was two at the time, but the baby that I was having. it was a very strange time, to say the very least.
I watched your interview with Greta. It must have been, what, a month after it happened?
It was probably about a month after, yeah. And in yet another parallel to Mrs. Owens, I thought, yeah, it's about the same amount of time as it took for me to go out in public and do a really out there, you know, sort of raw moment like that.
Yeah, I wanted to read. Do you mind if I read a quote? Something that sure. you said from that. And I re-listened to this like 3 times, and every time I watched it, I just thought, like, man, I feel like you were just like the epitome of a strong woman.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it's one of those things where like you don't ever want to find out this way that you're kind of built to sustain something like this. But I sure am glad that I was built to sustain something like this. It just turned out that my personality type and my faith and my, you know, everything felt like you have the tools to do this, which, thank goodness.
Yeah. So you said it's an impossibly sad, irreparable, sad. Oh wait, it's an impossibly sad. I can't talk. It's an impossibly irreparably sad thing that happened to us, but I am not an impossibly irreparably sad person, and my children would not be. You mentioned that Jake would have wanted you to live bravely and have fun, and that you'll probably always think that the world is a little less fun and beautiful because he's not here, but he would say it's your job to get off your butt and make it fun and beautiful.
Yep, that sounds right.
That's so good.
Yeah, I had... I think I said at some point it would be really easy to be afraid of everyday life because my husband died doing something that he did all the time. He was just living everyday life. And there is, you know, there's a realization of fragility in that and mortality. There's also some freedom in thinking like, look, we've seen, you know, God willing, some of the worst that will be thrown at us. And we can move through it. But I was very concerned from the beginning about feeling like I needed to like shelter my children in such a way that they couldn't experience things and that would sort of haunt me. And so I prayed and tried really hard to not let myself do that. And it's going to be a constant battle, as it is for all moms, by the way. And that's not just, it's not just people who have been through tragedy. This is the fight we all fight with ourselves. But it would be so... the antithesis of Jake for his kids not to take risks and for them not to feel like they could explore. So I wanted to avoid that. And I also tried to make clear from the beginning, because I felt like we were this ridiculous Lifetime movie plot, that I was really afraid that we would walk into a room and make people sad. Mm-hmm. Like my children and I would walk into a room and people would be reminded of, oh yeah, terrible things happen. And isn't, like, I so didn't want to be that spirit in anyone's life. And I didn't want for my poor kids to have to be that when they're these beautiful rays of sunshine. And so I asked people specifically, like, you know, this is a sad thing, but I am asking you to support us by not thinking of us as a sob story. Because we're not. And I think, you know, the community surrounding me has been very supportive in helping me live that way. But yeah, that was something I was concerned about from the very beginning, that we would be scared and we would be sad. And like, obviously we were sad, but I'm just saying as a way of life, I didn't want to be sad. In fact, I adopted for our family verse, which I know a lot of Christian families have. Ours is, Proverbs 31:25, which is, she's clothed in strength and dignity and laughs without fear of the future. Because I have 2 little girls and I felt like for this house full of women, that was like what I wanted us to do. We were going to be clothed in strength and dignity and we were going to laugh without fear of the future, even when it seemed impossible. So that's been our philosophy.
And I like that. I think I was listening to you on another podcast and you said something along the lines of, you could be sad, but you saw the possibility of a happy life and you were going to do everything you could to make that happen.
Yeah. It's like, you know, immediately after something like this happens there, you know, there's quite a long time, longer for different people, depending on where you are, where you think like everything with the world is wrong. Like I remember thinking it, you know, the word horrific always came up in my head. I was like, this is a horrific thing that happened to us. Mm-hmm. And there's no getting around that. And you can't move that past that too quickly. But I did see, even in the immediate aftermath with like, you know, I mean, it's hard to hang out with a 2-year-old and not see some glimmer of hope. And then, you know, 2 months in, I had a perfect, healthy, beautiful little girl. And, you know, there's so much purpose in that. And there's so much, it's inherently forward looking to have a child. It's inherently hopeful that the world is going to be a place worth raising them in. And so I think having my kids around and having all of our family and friends there and seeing how happy that made them, was just a sort of inherently hopeful thing about this, even in the depths of it being so sad. Even when things are so, so bad, it's actually hard to be sad 24/7. Like there are going to be moments where the fog lifts a little bit, even if it's just the moment that you forget what just happened, which does happen. And then you come back to reality and you're like, ugh. But there are times when like your friends are going to make you smile. Your friends are going to make you laugh. Even with like, frankly, sometimes I have a penchant for like really bad gallows humor, and my friends were nice enough to indulge me in that. So there are going to be moments when the light breaks through and you just, for me, it was like, let's hang on to that because, that's what's going to lead us out of it.
Yeah. And I was listening to another podcast the other day. I think it was Rob Bell's podcast, and his guest was talking about how like nothing in this world will make you maybe like want to believe that there's a higher being or that there's good in the world than a newborn baby, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I also had, after much praying, I had like an incredible birth experience and a perfect baby. And she was like the nicest baby who has ever babied. Like she was from the very beginning was like, Mom, do what you need to do. Deal with that loud toddler. I'm just going to be perfectly pleasant and sleep when you need me to. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I really got so many prayers answered by her, and had this beautiful experience with her that actually, despite the fact that, you know, it's birth, it could have been traumatic on top of being horribly sad. And yet, you know, this whole community of women at this midwife practice that I was at rallied around me. I had my sister-in-law, Jake's sister, there with me. And it was this really beautiful, extremely painful experience. but the fact that that could be so full of redemption in such a sad time, instead of sort of driving me deeper into sadness was, I don't know. Birth is something you'll never forget no matter, you know, how it comes about. But that one was a heck of an experience.
Well, and you said in another interview, I heard that, that Jake went with you to your ultrasound and he knew you were having a girl and you didn't even know.
Yes. He knew. I was on the fence about whether to find out because I had not found out with my first. I'm a person who's very comfortable with surprises like that. And so I hadn't made a decision, but when we went to the 20-week ultrasound, which I went to at 24 weeks because # second kid, I asked the technician to just put the gender in an envelope for me so that we could decide later. Whether we would look at it. And I'm the kind of person who could have put the envelope on my bookcase in my room and never looked at it until I gave birth. So I knew that like that was a possibility. Well, she asked me to look away from the screen when she was writing the thing that she was going to print, but she didn't make sure Jake was looking away. So he saw it and he's got a really good poker face. And I was like, wait, because she said, oh, like she realized her mistake. And I said, wait, did you just see it? And he's like, yep. And so it was, I can't remember how many weeks later that he died, but it was probably between 3 and 6 weeks later that he had kept this secret from me, and I had been perfectly satisfied with him keeping that secret from me. And so, yeah, he knew she was a girl, and there was definitely a reason that happened. He had a moment where he met her before I even did. And I actually later at Christmas time went down in the basement and I had forgotten about it. And this is another one of those odd things that happens in retrospect. So bizarre. In September, he had gone to Camp David with the president. And there's a gift shop at Camp David that you can only go to if you're at Camp David with the president. So while he was there, he bought a bunch of Christmas presents for the entire family. And I had forgotten this, and it was so uncharacteristic for my husband to go Christmas shopping in September. And I was like, this is amazing. We've got Christmas half done already. But I put those bags in the basement, never really thought about it again. Around December, I was like, oh, wait, I have presents, which, first of all, amazing. We have presents from Jake to give to people. Mm-hmm. Then I go down and I take the stuff out of the bags and thoroughly go through it. And there was a little pink Camp David onesie.
Oh.
Yeah. So she has one present from him that I never knew existed until December. And had I looked earlier, I would have known she was a girl, because there's no other reason for him to buy a
six-pack
onesie. So my life feels very much like a screenplay sometimes. So
yeah. When's the movie coming out?
I know, right?
Oh man, yeah. That's so special. You have to like put that onesie in a frame or something. Well, she's through with it now. How old is she?
Well, she's now 15 months.
Oh my gosh.
But actually, you know how these things go when they're marked 6 months? That thing could last for like another 3 months probably. But I did let her wear it, because much like my philosophy on all of life, I was like, I don't want this to be so fraught with importance that we don't enjoy it, right? Like, I don't want it to be so wrapped up in his death that we don't actually live. So she wore it. I didn't worry about her slobbering on it. It's been cleaned. It looks fine, and we will frame it and keep it forever.
Well, and that's based on everything that you've said about him. That's exactly what he would have wanted you to do.
Yes, yes.
So did you hike Mount Kilimanjaro on your honeymoon?
Yes, we did. It was awesome.
That's crazy.
So he suggested that actually after we got married. We got married in April of 2011, and in November we went to do Kilimanjaro. We figured, and we were right, we figured for people who are pretty wrapped up in their jobs like we are, that taking 2 weeks to just do something gigantic that opportunity was not available that often. But once you've just gotten married, people will pretty much say, like, okay, yeah, fine. A honeymoon is 2 weeks. Have your fun, right? So we took that opportunity to do something big, and I'm glad he suggested it, because I don't think it would have occurred to me. So we went and we hiked Kilimanjaro. We spent 6 days doing that. Watched the sunrise at the summit. And really just one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, because you're watching the sunrise from, 21,000 feet, I think. And the sun is rising over a peak adjacent to you, Mawenzi, that is 17,000 feet. It's crazy. And although I had some pretty bad altitude sickness, I will never forget that moment. It was really beautiful. And another thing from my screenplay, the morning that I had my second, I was sitting there recovering. I did it in a birthing center. So I was laying in the bed with her. Everything went like textbook. I was eating breakfast. They had made me some mini quiches, and I had a Starbucks cider. And I was having breakfast watching the sunrise, because it was about 6 in the morning when she was born at 5. And I pulled up my phone, and my Facebook memory was the picture of us at the summit with the sun rising. On like, what are the chances?
Right.
And so those two sunrises will be forever connected.
Oh. I want to hear about this, because you had your daughter at a birthing center.
Yes.
But you didn't do that with your first, right?
I didn't. I had my first at the hospital. And I feel it's funny, because I feel like it's a very sort of counterintuitively crunchy philosophy of mine about birth, right? But I had a pretty routine first birth. I did have to be induced. But the actual birth was fine, and I did it like for all but 20 minutes without the epidural. I did that thing where you break and finally they give you the epidural, and then you're like, oh, never mind, you need to push now. So I did that little game, which was actually fine. It turned out it just got me over the, you know, that last little bit of transition, and I, you know, had a kid like 40 minutes later. So I had a pretty good birth the first time. The second time around, I wanted to try at all costs to avoid being induced, just because there was a reason for it. There was a medical reason for it when I was induced the first time. But I thought, like, if there's any way I can avoid that, I would love to just do this without the Pitocin. So I felt good about the birthing center. I felt great about the midwives, and good about my chances of being able to do this in a routine, healthy way, as long as everything looked healthy with the pregnancy. Of course, once Jake died and there's all this trauma introduced, I saw the midwives. I talked to some folks to see, like, what's the best way to take care of myself? What's the best way to prevent this, you know, taking my healthy pregnancy off the rails? And from the moment he died, when I was like 30 weeks pregnant, I was just like, please let this baby go full term. Please let her go full term. And I would, at that point, all of my birth philosophies aside, would not have minded at all if someone from the midwife practice said, you know, it might be better if you transfer to a hospital. That would have been fine with me. But they all seemed very confident that everything looked great. All the readings and everything were totally normal. And looking back on it, it's funny. I'm so glad that no one second guessed me, because, you know, it would have been like not crazy to say, hey, lady whose husband just died, you're going to do an unmedicated birth at a birthing center. Have you thought that totally through? And I'm really glad nobody questioned me about it. It turned out wonderful. The birthing center was great. The people surrounding me were wonderful. And it was a, like, perfectly healthy, routine birth that, again, hurt like hell. But but it was about 6 hours of labor. And my first had been 12, so that was really nice. 6 hours of labor. She was born at 5:15, and I was home with her at 9 in the morning.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this, because, you know, I've had 3 kids, and afterwards in the hospital, and you did this with your first, they do all, like, the oxygen test and all the newborn screenings. Like, what does that look like when you do it at a birthing center and then you go home?
It looks slightly different. So they do all the regular APGAR and like the very basic testing there. And I made sure the one thing I was concerned about is that my first child was jaundiced a little bit. So I just wanted to make sure that her levels were fine, and they do that testing there. So they kept me informed of that. And then just like, with a hospital, once you're just discharged, you make a pediatrician's appointment within, you know, a day. Right. So I saw my pediatrician just a day or two later, maybe actually the next day. So she was definitely being seen regularly, specifically because I wanted the jaundice to be checked out, and she was totally fine. And it's like, it's not a thing that's for everyone. I'm not one of these people who's like, you must do it this way. But there were definitely advantages to it. And I just had such a really lovely, perfect experience when I really, really needed it. So I think I was very blessed and glad that I stuck with that decision.
And so you mentioned your brother came and lived with you guys, right?
Yes. He lived with us for 6 months after Jake died. He came for the funeral and never left, because he did freelance work, coding work, so he could do it from anywhere. So that was, I mean, one of the most amazing things anyone has done or will ever do for me. And he was great with the kids. He and my oldest now have this great little bond. He did, and the younger too, but specifically her, because she was, you know, between 2 and 2.5. And really, he filled, you know, obviously nobody's going to fill that void, but having him in the house made it feel like less of a vacuum where Jake had been. Just like, you know, there was a dude in the house. Like, he was like around, and he was fun, and not to be too heteronormative, but he was taking out the trash and he was fixing things, and he was just taking care of business. And it was really, really important to have him around. And so he was there the night that I went into labor. And he's great. Such a, like, he's an unperturbable person. Like, he's just very calm. And so in this, particularly in this situation, he was like, okay, you're in labor. Great. Let me know what you need. And so I labored for about 3 hours at the house till about 3:30 in the morning, and then went over to the birthing center and had the baby at 5:15, and called him, and he was like, "It's the most my my brother and me conversation of all time." He's like, "Hello, hey, it's me. Yeah, I had a baby already." I said, "Yeah, it's a girl." "Oh, congratulations." He's like, "Call mommy and daddy." "Okay, bye."
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. It's like
the most, you guys are just sisters, right? You don't have brothers in the family?
Right, just three girls.
Yeah, it's such a brother-sister conversation. Like, that's the conversation you have with a brother. You have a totally different conversation with a sister. But anyway, yeah, so he was there for that. And, you know, my parents were there shortly after, and everybody was at the house together. So, it was very cool.
I can relate to that. My husband has three sisters. So whenever anything big in their family is going on, I'm like, he's the one that's communicating to the family instead of me. I'm like, give me the phone. Let me talk to her.
You're not getting all the information we need.
I need more than just the basic facts. I need some detail here.
Yes. Yeah.
And then Jake's sister was with you when you delivered?
Yes. And she had never been to a birth before.
Oh,
so,
gosh.
So good for her for taking it on. But you know, there are different people who everybody approaches birth in a different way. And for me, I really, as somebody who runs and climbs mountains, it has always felt very logical. And I don't know if this is for you too, as an athlete, that felt very similar to, I'm going to do this pretty grueling thing.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to be like, why would you want to do that without painkillers? But in the end, there's going to be this great reward. And this is kind of the journey that I'm on, and like the payoff is so gigantic for this thing that you're doing. So I always thought of it kind of in those terms, and I knew that his sister Britt would have a similar point of view, and Jake did as well. Jake was very coachy, like like, I know how much you can take, I know when to push you a little bit, I know. And same with whenever we would hike together. We did a hike in Wyoming that actually my second born is named after a canyon in that hike. We did a hike at up to 10,000 feet that was long and kind of tough, and there was snow all over the trail. But he really knew, even when I was 7 months pregnant, this is how much you can take. I know sometimes I can push you a little harder and you will succeed more than you thought you could. So I felt like we had a really good vibe when it came to birth that way. And I thought Britt would be similar, and she really was. It was a really nice experience.
Yes, birth is it's an endurance event for sure.
Yes.
wait, you guys ran a marathon together too, didn't you?
We did, and well, together is a loose term because he's way faster than I ever was. We ran in 2011 together.
Okay, so you didn't run the race together, but you both ran the marathon.
We both ran the marathon. Yes. He was a much better runner than I, but but it was a great race, and actually I ran it just this past year. I did 2011, the Marine Corps Marathon, and then I did this past year in 2016. And it's the first time I had done it since 2011, partly because I had such a great running that day that I was like, I don't really want to mess with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But on that day, even though he was running so much ahead of me, there was a switchback in Georgetown where we actually, in a crowd of, you know how many people run that? What, 30,000
right.
people? I actually saw him on the course in Georgetown. I actually got his attention, and we said hi to each other. And it was at the time it was just like, oh, that was neat. How could that possibly happen? But in my head now I have this very vivid,
aww,
sunshiny moment where I darted across the course and was like, baby, it's me. And he's like, oh my God, hi. And, and then, we ran apart, but such a cool moment. And what are the chances you run into him in a 30,000 person race? But
right. So you ran it in 2016 for the Travis Mannion Foundation?
Yes. So I'm on the board of the Travis Mannion Foundation, which is a vet services organization that actually essentially teaches a character development and public service program to kids around the nation. And the idea is to sort of inspire new Travises out there to, be heroes and be, serve with duty and to, put themselves out there in cool ways. And so they're a great organization. Ever since Travis died in 2007, they have run the family or members of the family have run the marathon together and had a team. And so that's, we did it with them in 2011. And then this year, I ran it in honor of Jake and raised a bunch of money for them. And, it was a really beautiful run. Actually, my other brother, not to be outdone by Owen, joined me for the marathon and ran the marathon with me. He had never done one before. So we had a great run together and a really nice moment for us as well.
So tell everybody, who was Travis Mannion?
He's a, he was a Marine who went to the Naval Academy. Oddly enough, he and my husband were in the same class at the Naval Academy. My husband did not graduate from the Naval Academy. He did 2 years and transferred to Vanderbilt. But he and Travis were in the same class, didn't know each other well, but after Travis died and I started dating my husband and he became involved with the foundation, we all figured out that they had been classmates. So pretty strange. So Travis was killed in action in Iraq in 2007, and the foundation just sort of grew organically out of his family's desire to honor him and to make sure he was remembered, and started initially with this marathon run that they had, I think, I want to say like 200 people running the first year, because Travis had promised to come back from his deployment and run the marathon with his dad. So he had signed up, and so everybody ran together. And it just sort of grew out of that, and the desire for, you know, members of the 9/11 generation of combat vets to be remembered in their communities and to make sure that we highlight what they've sacrificed. And so one of the ways we do that is just basically to send ambassadors from the veteran community out to local schools and say, hey, this is what we're about. This is what people like Travis were about. And, you know, it's serving a calling higher than yourself. And it's a really powerful thing to be part of, to see, see kids make those connections and to see the larger American public get connected with the military public or the military part of the American public, which we have not been that great at doing in the past. And like a lot of people don't have that connection. So it's nice to be part of an organization that builds it.
When you ran the marathon, were you like, did you have any kind of, I don't know, moments of, you know, just kind of like when you cross the finish line, do you see it as like any kind of like monumental thing in your life, like post Jake that you'd done?
Yeah. I mean, I did it for, well, one, to raise money for the organization, and two, to just be like, you know, this is a very concrete way to show people and to show my kids, frankly, that this is what you do. You get up and you put one foot in front of the other. And sometimes you do it for 26.2 miles. But yeah, no, I knew it was like it was a lot to ask of myself, and it was a lot to try to fit in training when I was trying to figure out the rest of my life. Also, when I was 7 months pregnant and my husband died, I suddenly wanted to go for a run more than I've ever wanted to go for a run, and could not do it because, you know, I was like just worried about carrying this baby to term, and I hadn't been running regularly before that. So I was like, you don't want to risk anything.
Right.
So it was really nice to be able to fit that back into my life again and to embrace it. And, you know, I'm not a natural long distance runner. It's not my thing, which is funny because I've done several marathons, but it's not really my thing. It was much more Jake's thing, but I feel like he was, like sending me a message occasionally during training when I would be like, wait, I think I'm actually enjoying this. Cause he was definitely the one who was like, got to run to clear my head. It's going to be such a great experience. And I was like, I guess I'll run. So I had some moments during training that were really nice. And I would say during the race, it wasn't as sort of like emotional as I expected, partly because it felt, instead of emotional, it felt very like a community experience. There's so many people on the course. There were a bunch of my friends who came out to cheer for me because they knew this was such a big deal. My brother was there. My family was there. And so seeing all those people on the course made it this very sort of celebratory community thing, as opposed to me sort of living with my thoughts and memories. But in the very last mile, when I was by myself, I queued up my phone to play Wait For It from Hamilton, which is like to me, a great running song. And just like uplifting and emotional. And so I played that for myself for like the last mile or half mile. And I did, unlike my last marathon, I did do something more resembling running up that last hill than I had done in the last one, because that last hill is really not fun after 26 miles. But I was determined that I was going to actually run up it instead of stumbling sadly up the hill. So I did manage that, and it was a really nice moment. To be clear, I cry at the end of every long race I do, so I'm not sure. But no, it felt great. It felt like a statement that, you know, we're back. We do things. We don't wallow.
I love that so much. Yeah, and you've mentioned like for you dealing with everything, keeping yourself busy, surrounding yourself with people, not being alone was huge in getting through it, right?
Yeah, I'm very extroverted, as was Jake. So I've actually wondered in the aftermath of this how much tougher it must be for people who are introverted, because so much of like you're planning a funeral and you're surrounded by people and you're having to do one of the terrible things about death is there's so many logistics involved, which you had never thought of. So I was surrounded by people constantly. Friends and family were always there. And like, that's not to say that I couldn't take time alone, but I found that very comforting, and sort of life sustaining for me to have people around. And I can imagine if that's something that drains you of energy instead of building you up, that would be a really tough thing to do, because to some extent you have to be surrounded by people, and to some extent you have to be responding to them, and you know, it's a strange thing, but it worked for me.
And you kind of mentioned like everybody will go through something horrible or tragic in their life, not as horrible as what you've been through, but trying to figure out a way to still be happy and move on, and like you say, the possibility of a happy life. I mean, you only get one shot, so you gotta live it.
Yeah, that's the thing is like, and one of the things I realized through this process is like, yeah, there's no guarantee that you get to live a life without tragedy. That's not, in fact, there's almost the opposite guarantee, right? Something's gonna happen. And so yeah, there was a part of this that was just recognizing that. And not to say I can't be mad about it and I can't feel cheated and all of those things are real. But also, if I'm only being angry about it and I'm only feeling cheated, I'm not actually being, I think I would be losing some of the experiences we did have together. Mm. If I am concentrating on the cheated part. So I don't know. Again, a lot of this is just my natural way of being, mm-hmm. but I did make some conscious decisions to try to keep myself on that track. And so it, you know, to the extent that you can feel better at that time, it was the better choice for me.
As a mom and a wife, I really look up to how you've handled it. And I think a lot of women do.
Well, thank you very much. It's always in the back of all of our minds, like what example am I setting for my kids? And this was a real clear moment where it's like, yeah, I can cut myself some breaks, but I do have a responsibility to send a message about this to my kids. And what is that going to look like? Because I'm the parent now. Mm-hmm. I'm what they have. They have a whole community of people who love them, but I'm the mom. And what does this look like to them when they look back on it? And so I don't know, that was part of my thinking the whole time, which I imagine most moms, it's a part of our thinking a lot of the time.
Well, I have a feeling those two little girls are going to be super strong young women and adults for sure one day.
Well, I hope so. My toddler is already really, really can put her head down and do battle. So
how old is she?
She's 3.5. I have now a 3.5-year-old and a 15-month-old.
So. Man, that is hard. I mean, Three. So my kids are 4.5, 2, and then I have a 4-month-old. And man, 3, oh. Like the age 3 with my oldest yeah. one was so hard. I don't know yes. if you're dealing with like the crazy temper tantrums.
You know what? We did the first half of the year, but okay. that's kind of sloped off. Now it's just like straight up 13-year-old attitude.
And I'm sure it's very different with girls too. The way the attitude yeah. comes out, for sure.
Yeah, I get a lot of what did I get the other day? Like, seriously, Mama? I was like, I can't really complain because that's coming straight from me. Uh-huh. Like, I know where that came from. But yes, no, I have full confidence that they will be. Nobody's going to be pushing them around.
It's hysterical when they come up with things like that. You're like, I mean, I know you heard that from me, but like, how is this happening that you're like saying these phrases right now?
Yes, yes. Oh, and congratulations to you. A 4-month-old is super, is a girl or boy?
I have 3 boys, so I'm okay. opposite of you. I'm all boy.
Gotcha. Well, because I had 2 brothers, I was very confused by the fact that I birthed 2 daughters. I was like, what? What?
Yeah, actually, I mean, to be completely honest, you do strike me as someone who would do really well as a boy mom too.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to do either, but it was like, so
yeah,
I found it very, obviously once I had my second, and Jake had died and all this had happened and puts everything in perspective, you know, I was like over the moon, and as you would always be with a kid. Mm-hmm. But I remember while I was pregnant, and he knew the gender, and I didn't. I remember thinking like, do I need to know the gender so that I can adjust to the idea of having 2 children or 2 girls? Like, because uh-huh. in my brain that was so strange.
Yes.
So, but they are a delight, and I'm just having a blast with them. And like I said, they've got plenty of uncles and now increasingly at least 1 cousin, so it's gonna be good times for them.
That's so fun. Yeah, my kids have lots of little cousins they run around with, and it's a lot of fun.
Before I continue my conversation with Mary Catherine, I want to thank the Runner's World Women's Getaway for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Have you guys heard about this getaway yet? It's at the Westin Riverfront Resort and Spa at Beaver Creek Mountain in Avon, Colorado. The soul gathering for women by women, the perfect weekend getaway to recharge with your girlfriends. Runner's World editors will be there along with world-class marathoner Shalane Flanagan and Whole Foods chef Elise Kopecky. This retreat is designed for female runners of all ages and abilities. These weekends of rejuvenation and inspiration will give you the chance to laugh and play with your friends and connect with new friends while taking a moment to reflect on the transformative power of running to reinvigorate your life. It's a 4-day, 3-night deal, so grab your girlfriends and fun with this little getaway. You guys can email getaway@runnersworld.com for more information, and check out the show notes of this episode to register and see what it's all about. All right, let's continue my conversation with Mary Catherine.
So, okay, we end the podcast with some fun conversation, just random questions.
Okay.
And well, first, this doesn't have to be a long answer, but it's kind of a bigger question. Is there one thing that you haven't done in your life yet, like professionally, personally, traveling, whatever, that you are like, I have to do this?
Okay, a couple things. I'm a like semi well traveled person, but I actually haven't seen Paris, and my dad went to high school there, so it's like it was always very close to his heart, and I've heard so much about it. So I would like to do that. I would like to climb more mountains, not necessarily alpine, but I'd like to hike some more in new places, maybe South America, and the American West is just like so beautiful. And so any part that I can get to and do more of that, I'm happy to do. And then I guess the third thing might be, I might try my hand at some fiction writing at some point, since I've got this great screenplay anyway.
right?
those are the 3 that are off the top of my head.
Well, and you are an author. You have wrote a book.
Yes, I've exclusively written nonfiction up to this point, but I like historical fiction and I like fiction in general, so maybe someday I'll conquer that.
And what's the name of your book called again?
It's called End of Discussion, and it was written in 2015 or published in 2015, but sort of it holds up very well for the current political climate. It's a book examining basically how to have conversations and not shut down everyone who believes something differently than you with like immediately assuming the worst about them. So anyway, it's a fun read. You can get it on Amazon.com. Even though it's a political book, it is actually fun to read. I swear I'm not selling you a bill of goods.
No, I really want to read it. I really do.
I wrote it with my coworker and friend Guy Benson. And the idea was to, we're like, well, I feel like writing an outraged book about outrage would be self-defeating. So let's write a funny and enjoyable book about this challenge. And so that's how it turned out, thankfully.
It sounds really good. And I mean, talk about someone who has a fresh perspective and a real perspective, someone who, I mean, you've been there, you've lived
it. For sure.
Yes. Okay. I do want to read that. Okay. So what's the best advice you've ever been given?
My dad had a saying, which is a little bit more, has more curse words than I'm going to say it right now. But when I was young, it's going to sound harsh, but as I grew up, I thought, oh, he was right. He said to all of us, when we were sort of running with the wrong crowd or what have you in high school, and we'd say, it's cool, Dad, like, you don't even know these people, don't judge them, right? And he would say to us, don't hang out with messed up people because messed up people will mess you up.
Oh.
And there was more F word involved.
I was going to say, but I have a feeling I know what word it was.
But later on, I thought, huh. Like, because I think there is a tendency for all young people, in a really good way, to think they can fix other people and to sometimes get too deep into relationships that they shouldn't get into. And it's not to say that you shouldn't do that and you shouldn't be as loving and caring as you can. But as I grew up, like through my 20s, I thought, well, that's not a bad thing to think about every now and then. Thanks, Dad.
Good. What are you loving right now? Is there anything you've recently purchased or any sort of apparel that you're loving?
So two things. I do the Rent the Runway Unlimited, which allows me to get fun, way better clothes than I've ever worn once a week or however often I want to. It's like the old version of Netflix when it was actual physical discs. I get like three beautiful dresses and I can just wear them and then send them back and exchange them for new ones. And it's awesome. For my line of work on
right.
TV, it's particularly helpful. So I love that. And then I'm watching... just watching the TV show on Netflix, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Okay.
Have you seen this?
It's
hilarious. And I imagine you have a lot of women listeners, so I'm going to tell them. It is a musical comedy TV show about every one of your cringy, like, female insecurities that you've had your entire life, but somehow it's delightful. I don't know how she pulled it off, but it is a riot and I have very much enjoyed it thus far.
Okay. So I'm someone who's not super into musicals. Do you think that someone not super into musicals would still like it?
Yes, because it's an ironic musical.
Okay.
So it's sort of poking fun at the whole idea and every single song is ridiculous, not earnest.
So okay.
They're all just jokes and it's pretty fabulous.
What's the best, most recent book you've read?
I read Moonglow by Michael Chabon, who is a fiction writer whose writing is so beautiful. His most famous book is The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. I would suggest any one of his books to anyone just because I actually read one of them, and at the end of the book, I thought, huh, I don't think I liked any of the characters, and I'm not sure I cared about the plot, but it was so beautifully written that none of that mattered. And that was the exception. The others, like Moonglow and Cavalier and Clay, I have been deeply involved in the characters and the plot, but he is very skilled.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. It's as somebody when I explained it to them said reading a Michael Chabon book is like reading a Coen Brothers movie. It's that quirky, bizarre mid-century sensibility. It's very interesting.
Okay, it sounds like something my husband would like based on who you just compared the movie to.
Yeah, I bet he would like it.
Obviously the Travis Manion Foundation, but is there any other nonprofit you're super passionate about that you like to support?
So Jake and I did the Travis Manion Foundation and then a very nerdy one in San Francisco called Code for America, which trains a bunch of young people or recruits a bunch of people who are coders who frankly could be in Silicon Valley making a gajillion dollars creating apps, but basically directs them towards public service to make government technology more accessible and more actually working and frankly does it for less money than the government would do it normally. And I think that's a really niche thing, but it actually really helps people. So I like that one. And then there's an Aquila Foundation, which is in Rwanda. And a friend of Jake's teaches and trains a bunch of young women in Rwanda to work in the hospitalities industry. And they have this incredible, like, 100% job placement record. So nice. Those are the three.
Have you read the book Half the Sky?
I have not, but I probably should.
Yeah, I actually have not finished it, but I've gone back to it several times and read, you know, chapters at a time. But obviously that organization sounds like an organization that they would have highlighted in that book.
And whenever people say, like, oh, we're so divided and there's no way we can fix anything and the conversation can't get any better, I think about Rwanda and I'm like, talk about like society-wide healing and an ability to get past one of the most horrific, you know, divisions in the history of mankind. It's a really amazing story, and it's not to say it's perfect, but it's an amazing story what that country overcame and became.
Totally. Two more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any favorite people to follow on social media?
Let's see. Favorite people to follow. Let's see. Well, I love The Rock.
You are the second person on this podcast who suggested him.
Awesome. I love The Rock and Kevin Hart, actually. I think they're two of the most charming people in show business, period.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of weird things I follow. Oh, I can't remember his name right now. There's a guy on Instagram who just dresses up like other starlets and puts the pictures side by side, and he's like this big hairy man, and it's just hilarious. I can't remember the name of it. Those are the weird ones. I mean, all my political ones are normal.
yeah. Tell me, and then I'll let you go get on with your day. Tell me what Bright is all about, because I know my sister Erica contributes to that. What is that?
Yeah, so it's a daily or weekday daily newsletter that comes out every morning, and it's sort of just a take on the news of the day that allows you to digest it pretty quickly. Some serious stories, some quirky stories, some cultural stories, and we have five different women who write it, one for every day, and they are all, if I do say so myself, very interesting, fun, and have, I think, a unique perspective on the news and are really informed. And so I would suggest subscribing if you're into that. It's at getbrightemail.com. And it's just sort of a little bit lady-centric, although we get a lot of fan mail from dudes too, so you're not excluded. there might be more, but there's more like fashion and nail advice in our newsletter than there is in the average newsletter, I would say. It's a lot of fun, and it's a lot of fun to write, just to kind of break down the news of the day that I have been steeped in and kind of just get to the real, you know, the short version of it.
How is it? It sounds similar to the Daily Skim.
Yeah, it's a similar product, and actually the idea is, you know, we're all sort of right of center, but not in an alienating way. So the idea is, frankly, to give people an option or a supplement to the Skim, which if the reporting is to be believed, or is having a lot of dissension within the ranks about politics post election. Because being a neutral source is tough.
Yeah.
So anyway, we strive to be something fun and a slightly different point of view that's supplemental to that. It's fun.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to me.
Sure. It was fun.
Enjoy the rest of the day with your girls and whatever work things you have going on.
Thank you very much. It was good to talk to you.
Okay. See you later.
Bye.
Okay, everybody, thank you so much for listening today. Thank you, Mary Catherine, for coming on and sharing your story. And thank you everybody who has left me a rating review on iTunes. Thank you to all my Patreon supporters. Thank you Now Foods. And thank you to the Runner's World Women's Getaway for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. And if you guys know anybody who would be interested in listening to this podcast, I would appreciate it if you would share it with them. You guys can find all the show notes from this episode at lindseyhine.com. Have a great weekend, and as always, I will see you next Friday.